Members, we're going to get started. I call the committee to order. For some odd reason, we don't have minutes today. I can't imagine why just a few hours after midnight, you know, our staff just couldn't prepare that. But there it is. Yeah, really. I didn't get out of here until almost 11:45, and they were still picking up papers off the table.
And you're still home before I was.
I'm not. No comment. You're assuming I went straight home.
So did I.
we'll do minutes next time. So today we're going to be hearing a presentation from the Pulse Board. We also have four bills from Representative Dean, Joaquim O'Neill, and Quam. We're going to be laying those bills over because of fiscal cost. And then we'll bring them back up at some future date. I want to thank everyone for last night's perseverance and engagement in a very late session after a very long day. I do want to take a few minutes as a chair's prerogative and related to the presentation for our Pulse Board. Speak a little bit about the bill that I presented last night. You know, there were, in the chair's opinion, some broad mischaracterizations involved in discussions about that bill. So I just want to make it sure for the record, again, that the bill that I presented, 2709, is not a bill that's based on the AG's DPS report. It is not their bill. It's not based on their bill. It was written prior to the report coming out and is a result of an over-year-long process with many iterations coming as a result of various interactions with all sorts of stakeholders. We will, at some point, entertain a bill from them if the department forwards it. And it is my intent to honor the spirit of which whatever comes forward, and you heard some of that last night from testimony, that there's an agreement on issues, then what I would expect our committee is either to vote up or vote down those agreements and not step into them. However, at the same time, members, I just want to be real clear that the way I intend to chair is not to have decisions made by other groups prevent the legislature from doing its duty, a proper duty of legislating on related issues. We'll see if the bill comes forward, and then we'll have that conversation. The other thing, very quickly, you know, there was a lot of discussion around police data. You know, my bill didn't seek to publish individual police data. We will have that discussion in judiciary. And then also, my bill does not alter any criminal penalties on the police and is not an attempt to go after police. It was late last night, and so I know that there was some heated, you know, rhetoric that surfaced. But for the record, I want to make sure you know what my intention is and, frankly, how the bill is written, words on paper. My bill simply sets a bar on police-community relations. There's some other issues. I'll be planning to redraft a portion of those of my bill in judiciary. A number of you are on that committee. Particularly, I'll be looking at that Section 1 and 2. The bill does step into some thorny issues as it relates to criminal investigations versus licensure investigations, and it's pretty complex. Those issues are real, and they're a problem that I do think we need to look at, and we might even hear some aspects of that today in the presentation of the Pulse Board. However, it will be my intent at this point to withdraw those sections in the Judiciary Committee while we have, you know, a more deliberate conversation about those issues. As I stated earlier, there'll be some data revisits as well. I think it's important that we do balance out the transmission to make sure that there isn't a transmission, to make sure that there isn't the improper public sharing of individual data. However, individual data is transmitted, and bless you. And it's my intent to stay within the current constructs related to individual data. And then my final thoughts for you as committee members and to the public is that we've heard this consistently, the theme of redemption. We have tend to talk about it in terms of redemption for individuals, and I think that's appropriate. Our laws, in my opinion, should be guided by this adherence that that laws should walk with the well-being of our citizenry. And I think there's broad consensus across philosophy and parties here about the power of redemption and the necessariness of redemption. But redemption, as we've heard from a couple of testifiers in the past few weeks, isn't just an individual issue. Redemption is also an institutional dynamic, that there are there's a compelling voice for the redemption of systems, of institutions, including a redemption of this institution that arguably has put into motion in the last generation a series of policies that frankly have made it near impossible for individuals to in fact redeem themselves. So whether you're talking about the, you know, concepts under the mass incarceration state or the incredible unacceptable disparities, racial and income disparities that we have in our criminal justice and correction system, there is a strong need for us to look at ourselves and for our agents to look in the form of state institutions to look at themselves as well. And so today, and that's all about us playing the role of legislators to constantly push and encourage our institutions to grow and to change as we hear the voice of the people expressing how their actions are impacting their lives. So today we're going to hear from the Pulse Board as it itself is doing some examining and looking at the mirror. We're going to hear, and as they confront and reflect on their history. My hope is that we as legislators or leaders of agencies continue to do that work of hearing the voice of the people, examining our faults, constantly reflecting and rethinking our policies and practices, and looking for ways to contribute to individual redemption, but also to be about that from an institutional perspective as well. You know, our inaction, in my opinion, on this score does not serve the people of Minnesota well. So it is my intent that we act to the degree that we can, both as legislators and encourage our state governmental institutions to also act within the scope of their authority and their mission. And so we'll have a discussion a bit today about the Pulse Board's authority and mission and purpose. So with that, members, we're going to get started. Chair Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to make a little comment about yesterday afternoon. We had some very, very emotional, angry people here. That could have gone sideways real quickly. I'd like to compliment you on how you handled it. It took a little longer, but that could have turned into something really nasty, and it didn't. I believe those folks were happy to have the opportunity to get heard, and just wanted to compliment you on how you handled the situation.
Chair Carlson, I really appreciate that, and I also want to share that with committee members. Our lead Minority Party Lead Representative Johnson, I thought very concisely also conveyed sensitivity and openness and empathy as well for the testifiers. Knowing Representative Johnson a bit, I suspect that there was a lot there that he disagreed with. I will tell you that there were things I didn't agree with. I don't think that our state institutions are irredeemable. I don't think BCA or Pulse Board or Corrections or Public Safety are irredeemable. I think as a legislator, I frankly can't afford to think that way. However, hearing the voices reinforces the thought for me that it is about having tough conversations, listening to feelings and perceptions of our diverse population, and then constantly asking the question about whether and how we can change to reflect that. And so I do want to acknowledge Representative Johnson joining in that spirit of listening carefully. So, Representative Johnson.
I just wanted to thank every member here for being patient with them. As you say, some of the stuff was difficult to hear, but I think it was just best to let them get their emotions out and let us move on, because we do have very good law enforcement in the state.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. With that, we'll start today's hearing with a presentation of the Pulse Board. I'll have the representatives come forward and introduce themselves and provide us with their information. Good afternoon and welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon. I'm Kelly McCarthy and I'm the current chair of the Minnesota Pulse Board.
Good to see you, Chief.
And I am Eric Misselt. I'm the interim executive director for the Pulse Board.
Good to see you, Mr. Misselt.
First off, I would like to thank you for the opportunity, thank Chair Mariani and all the members for the opportunity to provide some information on the Pulse Board in terms of our business processes as they currently exist and a bit of our vision going forward. We had been asked to address a number of topics, but before we dive into that, I would like to offer some information that would, I think, help provide some context going forward. As you may well know, we have several new members on the board. We had a significant changeover at the turn of the year, including our brand new chair, Chief McCarthy. And it's with that change, there comes an acclimation period that I'm sure you understand if you've been involved in any of that kind of change on a board or an organization you're part of. Additionally, internally, and this does not get publicized as much, we've had an extensive turnover in key staff positions, including the executive director, which is why I find myself here before you today. Two positions at work in continuing education and standards coordination, which handles compliance and complaints. Additionally, we just added a rules coordinator during the last budget cycle to help us with the inevitable rulemaking that will come from change and with updating our business processes, which I'll be talking about shortly. I also want to say that the board has heard the concerns and many of the questions we have been fielding many of the questions in the last year. I certainly personally have, but I know our staff has as well. And the board is well aware of it. We are and will be taking action to address concerns that are within our statutory authority. Finally, I just want to say that it will take some time for us to gel as a team and gather data so that we can make informed decisions and shift our paradigms. The following are topics that we have been asked to cover, and I hope you members should have handouts in front of them. I will not read them to you, but I'd like to go through them briefly. I will identify as I'm going through these processes or through these topics, I will identify areas where we've already made changes in our business processes as well as others that we are exploring. So first off is the continuing education process. And there was a question about how that breaks down, how that is done. So I will refer to that. And the biggest thing I want to cover on, in terms of that document that you should have in front of you is talk a little bit about course approval requirements. When the Post Board approves courses for post-credit, instructor qualifications are vetted, showing proof of professionally recognized training and experience in the assigned subject area. Their learning goals, they need to provide learning goals and specific performance objectives, including a course timeline that shows a breakdown of the hours. In some cases, we have an instructor evaluation form as well. Now, one area that has been, scrutinized or have been questions about is how do we determine what courses are applicable and are authorized for post-credit. That is probably one of the areas that it is one of the areas that the Post Board will be looking at going forward, because as of right now, it is a fairly broad assessment. It has to be the course has to be law enforcement related, has to be based on the knowledge, skills, and abilities needed to be a peace officer, and it has to meet a law enforcement educational need. Again, very broad, and that is something that we have had questions about, concerns have been voiced, and something that we would look at in the future. The additional piece that I would like to cover, and again, this you can ask questions if you have questions about other areas, is the role of our continuing education coordinator. They do review all course applications and supporting documentations before they approve it. If the paperwork is insufficient, the coordinator will reach out to the sponsor and discuss those deficiencies, many times by phone, other times by email. If there's if further clarity, detailed lesson plans, or et cetera, not provided, the course will not be approved. So there is a process for vetting courses. In terms of what is done if a course sponsor is not meeting objectives or does not comply, their authority, particularly in terms of accredited sponsors, can be taken away. Accredited sponsors, for the record, are agencies or vendors that provide training, have been providing training for years. They have been vetted. They're known to provide good quality training, and they may submit courses and approve courses on their own. Again, without getting into the discussion as to whether or not that's a good idea, that is something that is in a rule and has been in place for many, many years as part of the post processes. In terms of current changes, the group that was here and spoke yesterday afternoon is a frequent attendee of post board meetings. And one of the concerns that they had and they voiced some time ago was the issue of course material that we receive when we approve a course being destroyed after the course is approved. And that was, in fact, the case, and that was our practice and policy. As of now, and again, speaking to a current change, we now keep that course material that is submitted in support of that course approval. In terms of future thoughts coming from the Post Board, we are exploring narrowing the types of courses that we will review. As I mentioned, the guideline right now is very broad. We are looking to narrow down the thousands and thousands, literally thousands of courses that are reviewed, given our limited staff, and a review that's based only on these basic requirements. We are thinking about, or at least I'm considering, approaching the board with the idea of limiting course evaluation and approval to the high-risk, high-liability areas, mandated training. As we know, there's a lot of mandated training for peace officers and those types of courses versus a broad brush of courses. The second topic that we were asked to speak to, and we'll take a little bit more time going through because it is fairly complex, as the chair mentioned, is the complaint and investigation process. Complaints that are alleging officer misconduct that are submitted to the board can be initiated by the public, peace officers, law enforcement agencies, or the post board itself. And all of those avenues have been, or actions have been taken in the past and continue to this day. Peace officers, any peace officer, which includes chief law enforcement officers, or as I will refer to them, CLEOs, are obligated under Minnesota rule to report any action which would constitute grounds for disciplinary action under any of the board's regulatory provisions. So there is a requirement that licensees themselves report any violations or any potential violations that would constitute grounds for disciplinary action. So how does the complaint process work? The receipt and an acknowledgement of the complaint comes in, and one of the first assessments that we do, that staff does, our standards coordinator, is we look at that complaint and we say, if proven true, and again, their due process is woven throughout this complaint process, if proven true, does it constitute a violation of the standards of conduct that are identified under our rules, 6700.1600? I would note that one of the questions revolved around how are CLEOs treated, chief law enforcement officers. Chief law enforcement officers are investigated the exact same way as any licensee. There is no difference. The only difference is that if we decide that there is a violation or there a potential violation and it's going to be investigated, we then notify the chief law enforcement officer of the complaint if it involves one of their officers. If it involves them personally, their supervising authority is then notified by the post board of the complaint. And that could be the mayor, city council, I believe that was referenced last night during the hearing, or county commissioner. They are notified. So that is if it appears that the violation falls within our jurisdiction. If it is not, and by not, I mean the evaluation is this a policy violation? There are department policies that are violated or allegedly violated by officers every day. There are accusations made against officers every day about a policy violation. We do not enforce policy violations of the department. We do not enforce their policy violations. That is up to the department, to the sheriff's department, the police department, to investigate that and determine whether or not there was a violation of their policy. Now, if that violation of that policy, let's say sexual harassment, for example, falls under one of our rules, standards of conduct, then yes, it does fall within our jurisdiction. That's a different story, which I'll describe in a minute. But if not, the CLEO or the CLEO supervising authority, again, if the CLEO is a subject, is notified and the CLEO is informed of their obligation under statute 626.8457, sub 2, to review and investigate the complaint. At that point, it is turned over to the locality, the local jurisdiction, to investigate. The investigation of the complaint. So if the board has determined this falls within their jurisdiction, board staff will either refer the complaint to a third-party law enforcement agency and order the investigation. The executive director of the post board has the authority to reach out to an agency and order an investigation, and they have 30 days to comply with that order and provide information regarding that complaint and that investigation. The board also has the option of pausing the complaint pending the results of an outstanding criminal charges. Those of you that are familiar with the employment law and disciplinary law of law enforcement officers, if there's a concurrent crime that is being alleged and is being investigated by the county attorney's office or someone else, that is to be kept separate from the internal investigation. So in this case, the board may suspend or may hold our investigation of that officer's conduct while the criminal case proceeds through the through due process and through the courts. The third option is to refer the complaint directly to the Complaint Investigation Committee, which is a membership of three board members, two of which have to be peace officers, for disposition. One thing that is often misunderstood, the Post Board does not complete or does not do investigations on its own. Our staff do not conduct investigations. Again, we order them out. We have someone else do it on our behalf. Records of any charges or convictions related to this alleged misconduct offense are obtained for review by the CIC. When appropriate, the board regularly consults with the Attorney General's office for legal advice. The Complaint Investigation Committee. Complaint handling is overseen by the Complaint Investigation Committee. Cases include a synopsis of the complaint prepared by board staff. And if there is a hearing on the discipline, peace officers and complainants are scheduled for an appearance before the committee, and they may appear before the committee with or without legal representation. When that hearing is concluded and each party has had their say, provided their evidence, if you will, the CIC is the unit or the group that determines the disposition of the complaint. They can refer the complaint back to the boards to board staff for further information or investigation. So if they feel they need more information to render a disposition, they'll do that. Or they find the complaint is substantiated or unsubstantiated. So what happens then? Substantiated complaints. When the CIC determines that the allegations of misconduct have been substantiated, there are a number of things that can happen. Settle agreement and consent orders, or what we call SACO, are promulgated, which identify the disciplinary results of the misconduct. Identified within there could be a surrender, a suspension, or a revocation of the person's license. The matter may be referred to the Office of Administrative Hearings if it's a contested case for hearing before an administrative law judge. We have been through a couple of those. More often than not, a SACO is reached beforehand. After the hearing, it's back to the CIC for action, and final dispositions that result in discipline are presented to the full board for review and ratification of the CIC's decision. Throughout this disciplinary process, the CIC is represented by an assistant attorney general who is assigned to prepare documents, present the case to the board, etc. They act as the prosecuting attorney, if you will. The full board is represented and advised by a different assistant attorney general, both at the regular meetings and when the board is ruling on a substantiated complaint. Unsubstantiated non-jurisdictional complaints, if the CIC is determines upon that upon looking into it that the complaint has not been substantiated, or when the board has no jurisdiction over the complaint because it does not allege officer misconduct as identified under the statutes or under our rule, the CIC will then dismiss the complaint. I would offer one follow-up to our brief discussion last night during the hearing, if I may, regarding data practices. I did want to reiterate that when the CIC, in this context, finds that there is no substantiated complaint, or does not fall within jurisdiction, the information on those complaints is not public data. Now, that does not speak to, in fairness to Chair Mariani's bill, does not speak to the issue of aggregate or summary data. I'm just talking about individual data regarding that particular licensee. So disciplinary actions that result from complaints filed with POST, I just wanted to cover what can happen. It includes suspension, revocation, reprimand, censure, imposing conditions on the licensee, and so on. And I wanted to talk briefly about what has the Post Board done in terms of, or what has been taking place in terms of discipline that has been handed down, final discipline by the Post Board, and refer you to Attachment D, which is the last 3 years of data from the Complaint Investigation Committee in terms of their actions. And primarily, I know a lot has been said about the Post Board has not taken action or has not been revoking licenses or holding officers accountable. And again, without getting down to that debate, because that's not my role, I do want to point out the statistics or the data, which is that in 2019, there were 8 license revocations for assault, violation of selection standards, criminal sexual conduct, sexual harassment, 2 of those, murder, manslaughter, and child pornography. I want to point out, in reference to the issue of are licensees dealt with differently than chief law enforcement officers, 2 of those 8 revocations are chief law enforcement officers. And in one case, it was for sexual harassment that was never charged out as a crime, was never, did not go to court, was handled as a violation of our rules, and the person's license was revoked. The other chief law enforcement officer was also sexual harassment, and that criminal case is still pending, is still out there being adjudicated. But nonetheless, the board took that action and revoked their license, again, prior to any disposition on the criminal side. Finally, in terms of the complaint process, I wanted to just talk about briefly the IADLIS, the International Association of Directors of Law Enforcement Standards and Training, in terms of how they fit into this picture. License revocations that are done by the board are reported to IADLIS, and they're included in what is called the National Decertification Index, or the NDI. This is a national registry of licensure revocations related to officer misconduct. All posts, as far as I know, in all 50 states contribute to the NDI. I'm going to skip the piece. I was going to talk about data practices, but we've kind of covered that, so I'll leave that open to you if you have questions specifically about data practices. But before I close out the part about talk about the investigation process, complaint investigation process, I wanted to mention that currently we're exploring changes for future rulemaking regarding such rules as to who must report possible violations to the board and better defining what constitutes a mandatory reporting event. One of the things we know is that relying on the definition as it exists in rule for the licensee to report out what might constitute a violation of the rules is, I won't call it vague, but it leaves it open to interpretation. And we would like to explore other ways to define better what you have to report, what doesn't need to be reported, and certainly what constitutes a mandatory reporting event. How am I doing on time, Chair?
We're running.
Okay. All right. I'll close it out then.
Thank you.
So one of the other topics we were asked to talk about was the background checks for continued licensure. That is an area that the Post Board does not currently do. We do not run criminal history checks of currently licensed peace officers, and we're not authorized to do so at this point. We do not have an interface or a terminal, as most police agencies do, to run these checks, and would incur substantial costs if it was run through the BCA. The BCA would incur costs, and they would have to logically charge us for that. Backgrounds, fingerprinting, criminal histories, checks are required by the employer upon hire. Now, we are currently participating in discussions regarding the RAPBAC program, which you may have heard of, which is being explored by the state and headed by the BCA. This would provide notification to the regulatory boards when a licensee is arrested, even out of state, and this would allow us to at least track and become aware of these potential violations so we can keep an eye on them, which is one of the ways that the Post Board gets this information and then is able to follow up and make sure we're doing our due diligence. Finally, was asked to speak about any things that we're thinking about down the road in terms of changing our paradigms, our business model. And I just want to talk briefly about the IADLIST audit, again, the International Association of Directors of Law Enforcement Standards and Training. We have submitted a request for information, which should be in your packet, to ask them to complete an audit of our processes, primarily in the area of how we do continuing education, some reference to pre-service education, recommendations on how our complaint process compares to other states, how are they how are these things done, the regulatory function, discipline, et cetera. The hope is that, or the plan is that, this will give us data that will give us an idea of how we sit compared to other states. The Minnesota model, particularly in terms of professional peace officer education, has been in place for 30, 40 years. It is a very different model than other states. So that's one area we'd like to see where we're at, and just generally see how we're doing. And it's a good place to start with some benchmarks. So, and as well as provide a snapshot of our current business practices. So in conclusion, I just wanted to say that, again, thank you for the opportunity to talk about the Post Board and what we've done in the past and what we hope to do going forward. And also mention a couple of things, particularly that at our board retreat in December, we had a board retreat to discuss strategic planning. We discussed increasing transparency and adapting to changing expectations within our statutory authority. Again, the board is well aware, and we are taking this, we are heeding this messages being sent. We are open to new ways of doing business, as demonstrated by seeking the IADLIST audit as one piece of it, not the only piece, but it is an important piece. And I am personally, again, not knowing whether I'll be sitting here addressing you as the executive director in a couple months' time or not, but regardless, if I am, I'm personally excited about leveraging our staff's talent and using data to shift our paradigms, instill a continuous improvement mindset, and improve our business practices. With that, I conclude my remarks.
Very well, thank you. Chief Mitchell.
Thank you, Chair McCarthy.
My apologies to you, Chief.
I didn't time my testimony from last night, but I'm really hoping to beat it, so bear with me. Thank you, Chair Mariani and members of the committee. My name is Kelly McCarthy, and I'm the current chair of the Post Board. I was appointed on July 1st, 2019, and my previous experience with the Post Board was that of an individual license holder and being at agencies that underwent three Post Board audits. After my appointment, I met with stakeholders, reviewed the statutes and rules. I met with employees, board members, members of the public, some of the people involved in the creation of the Post Board back in 1979. I'm still trying to get my head around the incongruent demands and expectations placed on the board. As a police executive, I'm used to dealing with conflicting needs and expectations, but this is next level. My primary takeaway thus far is that there's a lack of agreement and understanding on what the Post Board was created to do, what it does now, and what it should do in the future. We've reached out to some experts in the field, and then that's where the IADLIST audit comes in. And we're really relying on that right now as a first step to get us towards best practices. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I stand for any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Chief McCarthy. I'm really excited about the audit that will be underway, and very much look forward to hearing the results of that. I think it's a wise move on the part of any entity, including the Post Board, to have that kind of a deep look at your processes. And thank you for your leadership in that, Chief, and also to you, Mr. Missel, as well as to the many years of service at our Post Board, stepping in to provide a critical leadership function at this point. We do have a couple, several questions. I have one very quickly. I'm actually going to, frankly, set this up by asking our counsel here, because one of the things that, well, not one of the things, it was like the thing that My bill was focused on last night, had to do directly with the Pulse Board developing guidelines through its rulemaking process on police community relations. And so my question to council is, what do our statutes say about Pulse Board currently having the authority to enact such standards and guidelines?
Mr. Chair and members.
Mr. Debo.
It's House File 2709, the amendment that was before the committee last night, proposed adding requirements under the Post Board's rulemaking statute, which is 626.843, entitled Rules, Standards, and then a semicolon executive director. And that statute currently provides that the Post Board shall adopt rules on such matters that may be necessary and consistent with sections 626.84 to 626.863. In that range of statutes, there are a variety of topics covered, but they include community policing policies, the regulation of peace officer professional conduct. And so under the authority granted to the Post Board in their rulemaking authority, under Clause 13 of, 843, they have the authority to regulate the community policing, peace officer professional conduct, which is the realm that House File 2709 was and is intended to regulate and address.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Debo. And so, Chief, it seems that the key phrase there has to do with may be necessary. And so I don't want to put you on the spot. I just quickly, you know, want to get your reaction and sense of how we're reading the statute, what the words are saying, relative to this desire and a part of, at least on the part of my bill, that the Pulse Board move forward with community policing. So I'm not looking for a commitment as much as I'm just looking whether or not in your mind, what you just heard provides some direction and guidance for you.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Members of the committee, I would be interested in comparing the bill and the request and statute 626.8455, which is the training and community policing statute that exists, that does touch on problem solving, working with the community, training our officers in how to deal with diverse community, training our officers with how to deal with individuals with physical and mental limitations, child development. And so I think we need to do a gap analysis there and look at what is already covered versus what is covered in your bill. And I'm sorry, I don't have that done. And then we would look to see where we would need to adapt.
Super. I look forward to working with you, Chief, on that. We do have several questions. We'll try to move very quickly. Representative Dean, followed by Representative Howard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'll be fairly brief, and I don't know if this would be you directly, Ms. Litt, or Chief McCarthy. But so looking at these things and looking at sort of the course appropriation and how the process it goes through, I'm leading to my question about training effectiveness. And it seems like you have a process which is based on sort of instruction evaluation and not based on outcome evaluation. Am I reading this correctly, or am I not understanding what you're actually doing?
Chief McCarthy.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Representative, no, you're absolutely right. There is a lot of process documentation, and there is not a qualitative analysis of each class, primarily because we do not have subject matter experts on hand who could do those deep dives, but we are looking at options and best practices in other states to better inform that. And in addition to the training and once it's out, getting feedback from the participants. So chiefs or CLIOs are not on an island when they're trying to determine what training to send their officers to with their very limited time.
Just one follow-up, if I can, Mr. Chair. So as you move forward, I would just suggest, take it or leave it, that you start thinking about outcome-based evaluations instead of sort of the input side, because, you know, I've been in many, many courses where it's just about input, and there's no evaluation of have you learned anything. And I tell you, when you have to show that you've learned something through the process, you tend to pay a little better attention. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Dean. I think it's good and wise advice and encouragement. Representative Howard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this might be a question for Mr. Missel. I'm curious, in the event that, let's say, a city takes the action of dismissing a police officer in a rare instance when, you know, they've committed a serious breach of trust, a significant use of force violation, something like that, and then that case kind of goes through an arbitration process, does the post board have the authority to investigate, you know, either during or after that process?
The short answer is yes, but let me qualify that a bit. In this scenario that you lay out, the best way to put it is that the arbitration process and the employer-employee relationship and how that's severed is really a separate process from our licensing process. And so to the extent that that behavior, whatever that was that they were in fact terminated for, is a violation of our standards of conduct or any of our rules, or any of that along those lines, that's within our jurisdictional authority, we would certainly then initiate an investigation, no matter the outcome of the arbitration or whatever happened at the local level. We would do our own investigation if it falls within our jurisdiction, and then potentially there would be action against that licensee's license.
Okay, thank you. And then just one quick other question. Thank you for providing some data. Where did it go here? I was curious. It looked like the lion's share of the investigations were in this category of dismissed because of non-jurisdictional issues. It seems like 80-90%. And I was just curious, is there a breakdown of the nature of what that looks like and what the final end result in those instances are?
I'm sorry. Thank you. The direct answer to your question is no, we don't have a breakdown necessarily. However, agencies do have to provide, and included in these numbers are part of the aggregate data that they submit to us every year on allegations of misconduct in a report they do annually, which we post on our website, by the way. We're just completing the 2019 cycle, and those will go up in short order. So those may be included within here, but I would just offer this commentary in terms of the number of complaints versus how many result in disciplinary action. And I probably am preaching to the choir for many people in here, particularly if you've worked, and certainly my experience is in law enforcement, but if you've been worked in supervision in a public domain, you get a lot of complaints about things that your employees are doing. Some of them certainly are founded, and that's where they end up in showing up in those statistics where action is taken. But a lot of them are complaints such as, in my experience, the officer was rude to me. They called me a certain word or whatever, that sort of thing. That in and of itself is not necessarily a violation of our rules of conduct necessarily, but it could be a policy violation or whatnot. Now, that gets referred to the agency. They do their internal investigations, as I was referencing earlier. And let's say they have the body camera, and they go to the body camera, and none of that happened. Well, of course, then the complaint is unsubstantiated, dismissed, and we have no further involvement, and that's as far as it goes. Does that help?
That does help. Thank you.
And Mr. Missel, just following up on Representative Howard's question, does the board have concern about posting public agency-level data related to misconduct?
You mean the aggregate data that they submit? By agency, though?
By agency, yes.
Correct. No, that is all public data. I've processed numerous requests and provided that information. Quite honestly, the only barrier, and it's not really a barrier, is the format in which we have the data. Our systems are not particularly good at data mining and pulling that. So it's a manual operation, but one that we are we're currently undergoing. So with the new year being closed out, we would put that up by agency as well as the overall statewide data.
Very well. So the plan is to proceed with posting that.
Correct.
Thank you very much. Edelson, Johnson, Muller, then we're going to move on to our bills. Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Missel, I'm looking at Attachment E. There's a section or a number or a letter D lists other. And when you look at Attachment D, you kind of list out, you more enumerate what it's for. And so other, is that a pretty broad category?
Yes.
Mr. Missel.
So it could be... Oh, thank you, Chair. It could be assault, child pornography. It could be all of those things and other. Is that correct, Mr. Missel?
I'm not exactly sure, and to some extent, I'm a little bit behind the eight ball because I'm fairly new to post, and this was created many years ago. But I would assume that, if anything that doesn't fit in these top three categories certainly would fall into that other category.
Okay.
Representative,
actually, that's fine. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Representative Johnson, Representative Muller, and then we'll move on.
Chair Mariani, I just want to thank the Post Board. They do a fantastic job with what they have to work with. My post number was under 10,000. Not many of them left working. And you're about to retire. I just want to thank you for the work you do. I know that I have some current concerns with the amount of continuing education credits that our officers have to do that are mandated. In fact, today we have 11 more credits that are going to be mandated. And we're at a point now where we have more mandated hours of credits than the credits are required to renew their license. So it's something we have to look at. We also have an issue where the learning objectives for the colleges, especially the two-year program, the learning objectives, they cannot get done in a two-year program. It's more credits required than the two-year degree requires. So it's something else that we need to look at, get the main required objectives in and the fine-tune the ones that are needed on the road with the 6 to 1 year probation period that they have to go through.
And Mr. Miss, I suspect that the audit's going to look at this and help with this issue. Mr. Miss?
Well, thank you, Chair Mariani. Yeah, that's the plan anyway. We hope that'll inform us. I just wanted to follow up again along those lines. I think the issue of thousands of courses, and this speaks to the representative's question about qualitative versus quantitative or structural analysis of a course, it is definitely problematic. And I think it fits with Representative Johnson's comment that we need to somehow narrow this scope down so that we can do more in-depth review of the education that is really critically important to the job. I'll just leave it. Well, I would just add, too, as well, Chief McCarthy referenced the issue of not having the capacity or we don't have the subject matter experts. I will say this about your bill, Chair. The appropriation of the money is exactly what is needed because the Post Board is not designed, has not been designed, has not been intended to be a training arm in the past. If we shift that paradigm and we become much more involved in the nuts and bolts of training, so to speak, we will need the additional staff and subject matter experts to do that. Thank you.
Representative Mueller, and then we'll move on. Oh, you're good. Okay. Yeah. Very well. Any last thoughts for the committee? All right. Sure. Well, thank you so much for being with us today. More importantly, thank you for your leadership at the Post. Looking forward to what I think will be a pretty exciting year as you engage in the audit and do these deep reflections and as you engage with this body as well. So thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you.
All right, members, we have four bills. We're going to move as quickly. My hope is to move as quickly as we can. I would ask the authors and the testifiers to be as concise as possible. If I'm feeling that you're not being concise, please don't take it personally when I encourage you to move along. So first up, we have House File 36-30. And members, our intent is to lay these over. They all have costs. So this won't be the last time we'll be talking about these, but we want to get the proposals and the concepts out before us, both in the authors and the testifiers. So Representative Dean moves House File 36-30 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. And again, I'll be laying this over. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that's good to know. We'll continue having conversations on this in the future. This bill before us, 3630, addresses the issue of officer training regarding around interactions between those individuals with autism and officers. And I could talk about this bill, but I have other people that are more knowledgeable, and so I'm just going to turn it over to them. So I think that Ms. Julian Nelson will be the first to testify.
Very well. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thank you for taking the time to consider House File 3630 today. I am Jillian Nelson, and I am the Community Resource and Policy Advocate for the Autism Society of Minnesota. I am also an autistic adult. This bill will bring Minnesota to a more inclusive place by requiring autism training for all peace officers in Minnesota. Currently, only three states mandate training: New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Florida. Autism is a lifelong neurological condition that impacts the way people experience the world through communication, socialization, and sensory processing. Nationally, 1 in 58 people are living with autism, with even higher numbers here in Minnesota of 1 in 42, ranking us number 2 in the country. With numbers like these, there is no doubt that officers interface with the autism community on a daily basis. Autistic people are 7 times more likely to be a victim of a crime because of vulnerability, and 12 times more likely to become involved in the criminal justice system with no criminal intent. With House File 3630, individuals with autism can navigate those unavoidable interactions safely. The bill will mandate 4 hours of training, covering autism overview and behavioral understanding, best practice interventions and de-escalation strategies, prevention and crisis reduction models, and an objective review of tools and technology available to assist officers. It is vital that the training they receive be more than just informing them that autistic people exist. Rather, it needs to offer tools and strategies to help safely de-escalate and support people on the spectrum. This training will be developed in an equitable manner, including collaboration from adults on the spectrum, family members of autistic individuals, autism professionals, and members of law enforcement, all of which we have brought to speak to you today. This design is to ensure that our officers have the tools they need to make decisions in crisis situations that are respectful and the most impactful for working with this unique community. As a state, we owe this change not just to the autism community, but also to our officers. Last session, you passed a law that allows individuals with autism or mental illness to disclose their diagnosis on their ID. This is placing a large responsibility on our officers to have the appropriate training to react to that information. And currently, it's creating a false sense of security to our community that expects our officers to know what that disclosure means. Passing this bill into law is the only logical step to follow the law on disclosing on a state document. To do anything less would be purposefully setting up both our autism community and our officers to fail, and both deserve better. There is a small financial piece to moving this forward. However, if every officer in the state uses this training one time in their career to avoid an unnecessary medical transport of a person on Medicaid, it will save our state over $36 million with one use per an officer. And the peace of mind it will bring to thousands of families is priceless. And now that I have offered some background, I want to introduce three testifiers. We have an officer, an autistic adult, and a parent.
Let me introduce.
I'd like to first introduce Jen Foster with Brooklyn Park Police Department.
Welcome, Officer Foster, to the committee.
Thank you. Hello, ladies and gentlemen of the legislature. Thank you for having me here today. My name is Jennifer Foster, and I'm an officer with the Brooklyn Park Police Department and have worked there for the past 19 years. In 2012, I was fortunate enough to attend a training about autism and law enforcement interactions. This was my first introduction to the Autism Spectrum Disorder, or ASD, and the training to me was eye-opening and gave me some basic tools and information to help when interacting with citizens on the spectrum. I felt having this knowledge was so important to the work that we do in law enforcement that I came back to my police department and in 2013 assisted in getting together local organizations to put on an autism open house for the public with our police department. I have also been able to build relationships with organizations like the Autism Society of Minnesota and the St. Paul Police Department COPS Autism Response Education Unit, or CARE as it's known, to assist in teaching new officers in Brooklyn Park about autism and how to recognize a person that might be on the spectrum and help them with interventions and de-escalation strategies on calls. In 2018, I attended a training called Autism Spectrum Disorder for Law Enforcement. There I gained more knowledge on how to recognize and work with people who have an ASD diagnosis and be able to assist them in the best possible way while having police contact. I was able to meet amazing people who were brave and came to share their stories and interactions with the police and give us some perspective on how to help when someone with ASD might be in crisis or need assistance from the police. I was able to hear the point of view from a parent with an individual who has autism, who is grateful for the officers in the room for taking the time to learn about their loved one and help us gain knowledge to better help them on the streets if there was a need. Knowing that 1 in 42 people are on the spectrum made me feel that it is important to have this education and how we can best assist that person if they come into contact with law enforcement as we are meeting people that are on the spectrum in our everyday interactions. I have experienced how passing on this knowledge has helped officers on the street in firsthand encounters, including ones I have had myself. Last summer, working the street, I had a young male run away from his home and over to a neighbor's house. The neighbor was concerned as the child was nonverbal and the mother recognized that the child might have autism as she herself had a child with autism. As I was pulling up to the call, the mother of the missing child came out of her residence in a panic, stating her child had run off. We were able to reunite mom and son and the ability to also give them some resources as they were new to the neighborhood. I even got to see the family again on National Night Out and they were very grateful for the help. This is extremely valuable training and the information for our officers to have and help them in their everyday interactions with the public. We are the front lines for people who need help in all capacities, and if we are dealing with someone who has an ASD diagnosis, we officers should be trained in the best practices to help them and to do the job to the best of our ability. I feel fortunate to work for a department that was able to pay for and send me to these trainings and let me come back and assist in sharing this knowledge with the others in our department. Providing money for and mandating this training will give police departments across Minnesota a valuable tool to help them become better trained officers and assist those others in our community.
Thank you, Officer Foster. The rapid awareness in this area is correct and exciting to see. I think it's another way in which we're making public safety better. At the same time, equipping our peace officers with needed perspectives and skills. So I commend you for your training and for your police department's ability to provide that for you. So our next testifier.
My name is Noah McCord, and I'm a disability advocate. As I mentioned, I'm here to testify in support of House File 3630. I was diagnosed with autism at age 3. And in October of 2016, my older brother attempted suicide while serving abroad in the United States Marine Corps. When I got the phone call, I was stunned, I became overstimulated, and I experienced what is often referred to as an autistic meltdown. My parents worked very hard when I was a kid to train me to follow a plan, and as I often did, I cut through a path in the woods along the river in Chaska to go to my dad's church. Unfortunately, Chaska PD got called to conduct a welfare check on me, and in under 5 minutes, I was being football tackled to the ground, and I went into complete fight or flight mode. My entire life, I've been told that I don't look autistic and that I'm too smart to be disabled, but my biggest disability as a person on the spectrum is really invisible. In situations where I'm under extreme duress, my ability to communicate really shuts down and I'm unable to process verbal information. And later, as my dad reviewed the video footage from the Chaska Police Department, he pointed out that I was engaging in a repetitive hand motion called stimming, rocking back and forth, and basically exhibiting all the stereotypical signs of a person with autism that if they would have had any sort of knowledge on the autism spectrum, would have been easily identified. There's a variety of programs underway in police departments around the country and around the world to help law enforcement make those identifications, but there's still too few and far between. The scarcity of these programs is a sad legacy of the decades when autism was mistakenly believed to be a rare condition, and we lived out our lives in state-run institutions. We all know autism is common. We all know it exhibits itself in every shade and hue of humanity, and it's time that we take action to give law enforcement officers the knowledge that they need to avoid some normal aspect of the job turning into an explosive situation. Also, as my esteemed colleague Jillian Nelson stated in her testimony, last session I worked with Senator Dreheim and Representative Vogel to pass legislation that gives individuals with autism and mental health diagnoses a place to designate on a driver's license that they have such a condition and that there may be an underlying issue with the situation they are seeking to address. But there's really a difference between knowing and understanding, and we need to be able to support them in both. If we don't train law enforcement and we proceed to implement the driver's license designation program, besides all the problems that Jillian mentioned, we also are opening up municipalities and local law enforcement agencies to legal liability. In 1998, the Supreme Court found in Yeski v. Pennsylvania, Department of Corrections, that the ADA applied to state correctional facilities. In his opinion for the court, the late Justice Antonin Scalia wrote that the broad language of Title II of the ADA covers inmates in state prisons and jails. The ruling has been used by lower appellate courts to apply the ADA to virtually everything law enforcement does. In the Eighth Circuit in Roberts v. City of Omaha, the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals applied the ADA to arrests. In Gorman Varch, they held that local police departments fall within the ADA's statutory definition of what a public entity is. And in Ludwig versus Anderson, the Eighth Circuit held that emotionally disturbed status or mental health crises is relevant to a determination as to what level of force is objectively reasonable. Besides ADA claims, most law enforcement agencies also get some trickle of federal funding, which also subjects them to claims under Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973. In conclusion, members, supporting File 3630 basically is the crossing of the I's and the dotting of the T's. It not only protects localities from liability, but it also ultimately protects people who need it most. By supporting House File 3630, we're saying exactly what Governor Luther Youngdahl said in the fall of 1949 as he stood in the courtyard of Anoka State Hospital and burned mechanical restraints. We say to them that we understand them, that they need have no fears, that those around them are their friends. I strongly encourage you to say to the autism community that they are among friends and support House File 3630.
Thank you, Mr. McCord. I have so much appreciated working, interacting with you over the course of the last year, and I have to do a shout out here of acknowledgement of you quoting former great governor in our state to remind us of our deep-seated values and good principles to do the right thing. So thank you very much. We have another testifier, and we are going to move I am going to move quickly. I'll explain that after these last testifier. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Yes, I'm Jason Heisler. My son was killed. He was on the autistic spectrum, autism spectrum. He was killed during an interaction with police. Thank you, Chairman Mariani and the and this committee for giving me this opportunity. I won't take up much of your time. I know you had a late night. My son was killed when he was needing to be taken to the hospital in his living room in his underwear. I've witnessed a lot of interactions with autistic individuals and the police, and I'm sure the police are experiencing this more and more, and I know we can all agree that more training is needed, and that's why I support HF 3630. I've seen one episode where a young autistic man ran from Hennepin County Medical Center emergency room and tried to jump in the river, and in that instance, his family got there about the same time as the police and emergency responders, and the family was kept away while they forcefully took this individual into custody. And in that case, in a lot of cases, the family members were the most trained to de-escalate the situation. The police had no training and very little experience with individuals like this. In another instance, I know of a family, and I came and helped that evening, where a young man had ran away from home along the Brooklyn Center Crystal border, hiding in the Crystal Airport. And he was threatening to harm himself, and the police officers were able to ping his phone, but they wouldn't go interact with him because they were afraid they would make it worse. If he wasn't actively stabbing himself at that minute, they didn't want to engage him, and they just didn't know. I mean, that alone speaks volumes. So they would not, they'd stayed a block away following his phone and would not interact with him because they did not know whatsoever how to deal with the situation. And in my son's case, he was interviewed in his living room in his underwear and searched for weapons. And after what probably was about 10 minutes, I'm just going to touch on the agreed upon details because unfortunately this case is still sitting on Mike Freeman's desk 187 days later because we've had quite a rash of police killings, and the district attorney is very busy in Hennepin County. But what is agreed upon is that my son was interviewed, and when he found out they were taking him to the hospital, he got up and he was tased 4 or 5 times, and then he got up again and he was shot multiple times, including in the head, all because they were trying to get him to the hospital. And so I think that a lot of police officers, and definitely the autism community, all can agree, and hopefully you can all see that more training is needed. And if this is a question of appropriations and fiscal problems, you know, we're in a situation where the state and municipalities cannot afford the litigation and settling these wrongful death cases. If anything, any money spent on training is going to save money in the long run. And thank you very much. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Mr. Eisler. And you have my deep and sincere sympathy and empathy for the loss of your beloved son. Thank you for coming here publicly to share your story. I suspect strongly, as evidenced by the presence of Officer Foster here and conversations that we've had across the board, that both families and police officers are looking for and wanting the kind of training and awareness and skill building that you're calling for and your colleagues are calling for. Representative Dean, here's what I'm going to do. We have 20-25 minutes. I still have three bills. We're going to lay this over anyway. I'm going to move to lay this over right now. If there's still time before we adjourn, I'll take questions from committee members on this bill. This bill will arise again at any rate. at a future hearing as we either move it forward or perhaps incorporate it into a big bill. I could tell you I know that the Post Board had testified earlier, not on this, but just generally, about the fact they're going through an audit. I think that's going to be consuming energy and resources at the board. You heard the thankfulness of my bill for some resources. So resources will be an issue, and we will certainly cover those when we bring the bill back up. Any final words before I move to layover?
Mr. Chair and members, the only final word I would give is, although we can't change what's happened in the past, we can certainly redirect what's going to happen in the future, and this is an opportunity to do that. And I'll be around, and I'm sure a few of these witnesses, should we be able to complete in time and come back for some question and answers. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Dee. I do apologize. The clock is what it is. We do have a question for Representative Dash, and if we can, we'll get to that when we get through the other bills. So at this point, the chair.
Mr. Chair, there's another testifier that I know wanted to testify to this bill from the public.
We will do that if the bill arises at that point. The chair lays over House File 3630. House File 2934, Representative Joaquin. Chair moves House File 2934 be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. So, Representative Joaquin, Chair Joaquin, your bill is before us. Would you like me to move the A20 amendment?
Mr. Chair, that'd be wonderful. Thank you.
Very well. The chair moves the A20-0609 amendment. I take it this puts the bill in the shape you wanted before us. Is that correct?
Yes, it does. Thank
you, sir. Very well. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. House File 2934 as amended is before us. And Representative Joaquin, you just saw a demonstration of how the chair wants to move, so please move forward accordingly. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I listened to some of your committee last night. I know you had a late night.
Yes, we did.
As members, many of us bring forward bills that are born from experiences that we've had. For me, that's the case with this bill. My grandmother, who's now gone, had Alzheimer's the last few years of her life. At the time, she was a widow living alone. In her home with her children, when her children were sharing the tasks of helping her age in place. There was always a worry and a concern that she'd get out of the house on her own. They lived close to Lake Phelan, so the lake and the water and the cold in Minnesota winters were also a huge concern. If a vulnerable adult that has Alzheimer's, dementia, or traumatic brain injury does wander off, minutes could make a difference in our climate. In 2014, when I came to the legislature, this issue was at the top of my mind, and I had heard of a silver alert in other states and crafted a bill to have a working group look at whether a silver alert would be the best approach for Minnesota. That bill passed, the working group met, and you can see the recommendations in your packet. The bill you have before you is a scaled-down version of those recommendations, and I would like to thank the Alzheimer's organization for being with me every step of the way on this very personal project. Section 1 is an appropriation from the general fund to both the Office of Justice Programs and the Minnesota Crime Alert Network. And Subdivision 2, the OJP, would administer regional and statewide voluntary training grants to state and local law enforcement so that they can understand the population that they serve who has Alzheimer's or dementia. It is focused on law enforcement agencies that have less than 45 peace officers and has a report requirement to see how that program's working. In Subdivision 3, there's an appropriation to the Minnesota Criminal Alert Network to create additional categories to the Endangered Missing Persons Alert for those with Alzheimer's or dementia, as well as find ways to increase membership to the program. We thought this was, and the task force also thought, that this was a better approach than the Silver Alert. Since we have such an aging population in Minnesota, a Silver Alert may desensitize folks to having those alerts come out. So we thought this might be a better way. While I shared my personal story in the beginning, I know that it's not a unique one and that I'm not alone. I'm sure many of us around the table share similar stories. There are two letters that have stories in your packets. For time, you could look at those. I should also mention that besides the Alzheimer's Association, we have support from the Associations of Minnesota State Fire Chiefs, the Minnesota State Fire Departments, the Minnesota Chapter of International Arson Investigators, the Minnesota Fire Marshals, the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association, as well as the Minnesota Ambulance Association. all first responders that deal with our seniors and those with Alzheimer's and dementia living in our communities. I have three testifiers with me today that will very briefly describe why this bill is needed. I'll first kick it off to Josh Ney, Manager of State Affairs for Alzheimer's Association.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Ney. Is that correct?
Mr. Nye, but...
Not Nye.
Like Bill Nye, state your name, but spelled correctly. Exactly.
You think I know that since I worked with him in the Senate for quite a few years. Sorry.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Josh Nye, and I'm the Manager of State Affairs for the Alzheimer's Association. Welcome. Thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of HF 2934. Thank you, Representative Joachim, for introducing this bill, and thank you to the bipartisan co-authors on the committee for your support. Alzheimer's disease is a progressive brain disorder that damages and eventually destroys brain cells, leading to a loss of memory, thinking, and other brain functions. It can impair a person's judgment and cause disorientation and confusion. Ultimately, it's fatal. There are an estimated 97,000 Minnesotans living with Alzheimer's. This number is expected to reach 120,000 by the year 2025. 6 in 10 people with Alzheimer's will wander and may not recognize regular body signals like pain or dehydration, and may not stop to use the bathroom or eat. It can diminish a person's ability to make sound decisions, meaning people living with dementia are often at greater risk for financial exploitation, abuse, and neglect. Northfield Police Chief Monty Nelson couldn't be here today, but provided written testimony in your packet as a law enforcement official and as a caregiver of family members with dementia. He said, quote, law enforcement officers face challenges of recognizing symptoms of Alzheimer's or dementia and protecting and assisting those suffering the effects of the disease. Officers are not equipped with the knowledge and resources to help. If officers lack proper training, they will not recognize indicators of the disease and may respond ineffectively or inappropriately. Additional written testimony is in your packet. The goal with HF 2934 is to ensure that people with dementia are safe in their communities and that the first responders who are called when they need assistance have the tools, training, and resources needed to help this growing population. I ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nye. Thank you for your testimony and for your brevity and power of it. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Chair Mariani, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be before you once again. My name is Brian Peters. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association. I was approached by Josh a number of months ago when he was talking about the creation of this bill. And when he started talking, it reminded me of a quick story that I'm going to tell you early on in my career as a police officer. I was on patrol late at night, about 2 in the morning. It was about 37, 40 degrees, and I noticed an elderly gentleman pumping gas into his vehicle. Didn't think anything of it. I waved and moved on. About 45 minutes later, I came back to the same gas station and saw the man now sitting in his vehicle with the nozzle still in his car. So I went up to him and talked with him and said, sir, hi, introduced myself, what are you doing here? And he said, well, I'm getting gas. And I said, okay, well, you've been here for a while. And I started dialoguing with him. Could tell he wasn't having a medical condition. So I asked him for his ID. He didn't have his ID. I asked him, did you pay for your gas? And he said, yes. And I went in and verified that he had not. He had no money on him. What I did is I ran his plate and noticed that he had prior contact in our system. And, he couldn't tell me a phone number of a loved one. He couldn't tell me where he lived. And so luckily there was a phone number in the system that I called, and it happened to be his daughter. So I woke his daughter up at about 3 a.m. and told her where her father was. And she came and really explained that he has really started demonstrating the signs of Alzheimer's. And as a police officer, that was the first time I kind of heard that term. And as you go farther and farther in your career, you obviously deal with more people in this condition. So we're here to fully support the training that they are offering for law enforcement. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peters. You have yes.
One more.
There, right in front of me.
We switched chairs here real quick.
No, it's just that I got 5 hours to sleep last night.
thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeremiah Carlson, resident of Chisago County. Currently, I'm an active peace officer with the City of Brooklyn Park. There's no plans. I didn't know that my partner was going to be here earlier. I had a whole speech here kind of written out, but for benefit of time, I'm just going to kind of hit some bullet points on why I'm here in support and why I feel it's valuable. For over 18 years, I've served as a public servant. I've been a first responder, nationally registered EMT, and like I said, ultimately a licensed peace officer. In that time, the education that I have received in elder care issues, especially in memory care, dementia, Alzheimer's, is very limited for how much we actually deal with it in the street. Obviously, as we said, there's a lot of common stories, and I'm sure we could call multiple law enforcement officers up here to give the same stories about dealing with somebody who is starting to show signs of elder care. Oftentimes, we're ill-equipped because we don't have the knowledge and the resources to be able to provide adequate guidance to families that are in need. With this bill, I think that we'll be able to solve some of those issues. I think the Alzheimer's Association has done a great job in ensuring that this bill is not mandated on law enforcement, but yet is put out there for those that care about it. My experience working internally at an agency is our training comes a lot best when it comes from our partners. And this type of training where we get people that want to go to it and bring it back, that's where I can start picking up pieces. So not every officer needs to enter a room to learn and understand what's going on. With that being said, I fully support this as a trainer with MNCIT. I've been doing that for 4 years training the state. I do also appreciate that the narrative the Alzheimer's Committee wants to provide is a face-to-face type training, which allows officers to ask questions, Q&A formats, for them to be able to basically make those change behaviors in themselves because they can go back and look at the things in their career to ultimately hopefully provide better training at the end of the day so that they're more effective with this. That's pretty much my speech. I appreciate the time and the effort that you guys are putting into looking at this bill.
Well done, Officer Carlson. Thank you for your public service as well. And Mr. Peters, you know, that was a powerful story that had both a combination of just being, in my mind, a terrific story of an interaction with a public, someone vulnerable to the public, with the law enforcement, but also a frightening story in terms of that could have gone all sorts of other ways. So with that, Representative Joachim, I am going to move to lay this over. I do acknowledge there are several appropriation lines, or there's an appropriation to three different categories here, so we're going to have to lay it over at any rate to factor that in. But Representative Paulson does have a question. If we can bring this bill back up before we're done here, then I will have him pose that question to you at that point, if not when the bill comes back to us again.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I think you just want to make a comment as a co-author, but and I do have to be back in transportation.
Oh, that's a good one. As a co-author, yes. Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Representative Paulson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Joachim, thank you so much for bringing this bill forward. I was my mother and father's caregiver and conservator for both of them. They both died from Lewy body dementia. My wife, Pam, lost her first husband to Alzheimer's. So my stepdaughter, Bailey, lost her father to Alzheimer's. So this hits really close to home for our family. We've been through a lot of these situations that you've described. You know, people walking away, doing some funny things, driving at first, probably sitting at the gas pump, who knows. A lot of these things happen. The Alzheimer's Association does an awesome job. And, you know, we're really proud as a family to be involved in the Brainerd Lakes area, in the walk, and in other activities that happen there. And I'm really proud of my stepdaughter, who is an author of a couple now Alzheimer's books for children. So I just want to thank you for bringing this forward. This is going to help. It's going to make a big difference. Thank you.
Thank you. Rosa Paulson. Thank you for your co-authorship of this bill. With that, Representative Joachim, the chair will lay over House File 2934 as amended. Representative O'Neill, House File 3380. Representative O'Neill moves House File 3380 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing my bill today. This bill is requiring the Post Board to develop sex trafficking investigations model policy. And the reason that we need to do that is because a survey was recently done by OJP in December of 2019. And out of the 349 agencies that responded, Only 37% of officers believe that they were confident in their ability to actually identify a sex trafficking victim. Only 37%. Also, only 17% of agencies had a formal written policy about how to do investigations when it comes to human sex trafficking. So that is the bill. And in coordination, one last thing before I turn over to my testifier, the groups that will be working on this model policy will be the BCA, the Human Trafficking Investigations Task Force, prosecutors, and victims advocacy groups. And with me today, I have someone that I've worked with for years on all things considered when it comes to rape and sexual assault and of sex trafficking, and I'm so glad to have her with me today. In a different role, she used to be with MnCASA, and I'll let her explain what she's doing now and what she has to say about this bill.
Representative O'Neill, let me just take a brief pause here. We do have members from the Pulse Board here, and I've been meaning to ask them to stand up, and I keep forgetting to do that. And so if there are members of the Pulse Board still with us here? Have they all left? Oh, God. You know, Jamel kept, you know, doing this, and I got it, you know, and I didn't have it. So we'll do that another time. So at any rate, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Caroline Palmer, and I'm the Safe Harbor Director at the Minnesota Department of Health. I want to thank Representative O'Neill for introducing this bill. It's been my great pleasure to work with her over the years, and I'm very glad to be here today. And I'm happy to have the opportunity to inform the committee about how Safe Harbor partners with law enforcement. I do have a handout here about Safe Harbor. If, Mr. Chair, you would like it to be shared. I'll put it right here. Thank you. So over the past decade, and thanks to a substantial investment from the state legislature, the Minnesota Safe Harbor program has grown in its reach and ability to meet the needs of sexually exploited youth through the age of 24. Safe Harbor is statutorily based at the Minnesota Department of Health, and we are the only state in the country to center its human trafficking response in public health. That said, Safe Harbor also partners extensively with the Department of Human Services, Office of Economic Opportunity, and as well as their child welfare divisions. Most importantly for today's purposes, though, we partner quite a bit with the Human Trafficking Investigations Task Force at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, as well as the Office of Justice Programs in the Department of Public Safety, which provides grants for trafficking investigations. And in addition, Safe Harbor does provide support for the Tribes United Against Sex Trafficking, also known as the Trust Multi-Jurisdictional Task Force. Human trafficking investigations are among the most complex law enforcement can take up, and they do require significant resources. It's very, very important for law enforcement agencies to have policies in place to respond and that those policies are revisited and updated on a regular basis. Through Safe Harbor, for example, we fund 6 community-based protocol development teams, and the law enforcement response is not only integrated into the team's work, but also they work with local agencies to develop policies to enhance their response and build collaboration in their communities. They use a victim-centered lens, which is echoed in this bill language, and we're very excited to see that. This bill responds to the ongoing need for education in a highly complex area of law enforcement investigations. When Safe Harbor first started 6 years ago, the Ramsey County Attorney's Office led trainings for over 2,000 officers in the state, and the BCA now holds its annual conference. While training is important, a comprehensive policy will also provide further guidance as well as some standardized responses. It will also help law enforcement agencies coordinate with one another. And that's our ultimate goal under Safe Harbor, is we want to make sure that collaboration is encouraged and is happening across disciplines. So to conclude, I just want to say the Safe Harbor program is happy to cooperate in any way and work through development of policies for investigating cases. And we also want to bring to the table not only the work we're doing, but also all of our partnerships with survivors and survivor-serving agencies. So thank you very much, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. You know, we heard a bill, I think it was Representative Pinto's bill, last week, I think it was, and Stearns County work in combating human sex trafficking. Representative O'Neill, this sounds like just such a right bill to do. And I suspect that the Pulse Board would want to embrace it. There is a fiscal note that's asked on this, and so we're going to lay it over in order to have time to do that. And I see, Representative Pinto, you want to make a quick comment?
Well, just so, Mr. Chair, I do. So
we heard another proposal, both last year actually advanced it, and then I think we heard it maybe within the last few weeks as well, to have a coordinator of sex trafficking investigation work within OJP. And I guess this would be a question for the Post Board, but I guess they're not here. But I'm just trying to figure out whether the drug and or maybe somebody knows whether...
I'm not going to take questions at this point. I want to honor hearing Representative Quam. We'll come back to this.
Okay, good. So I'll just... I think we might want to... There'll be some changes, I guess, I think, that may make some sense that I can detail whenever the time comes. But I think we probably want to do this through that coordinator rather than through the Post Board. So I'd say I probably would have concerns with this as structured, but we can talk about it. Thank you.
Very well. Representative O'Neill, very quickly.
Just finally, I was also going to point out that Representative Pinto has been going around the state and doing training about sex trafficking, and he actually has developed a model policy. So if we want to just cut to the chase, we could just adopt something that he's already done. So we could do that too.
Well, that takes care of that fiscal note. very well. Representative Lee, I wish we could spend way more time on this, but the bill will come back before us for further deliberation. I want to thank you and your testifier. And at this point, the chair then lays over House File 3380. The chair moves House File 3117 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Members, this does have a fiscal note that does show a small expense, so we will be laying this over and kick it up again at a later date. Representative Quam, you and I spoke a bit about this bill. I think it's a good bill. Look forward to very briefly hearing about it. So your bill is before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the bill and the people at the table are here because of a tragedy and a death. And the intent of the bill is that the Post Board would look at updating a model policy and training in reference to confidential informants. And I will pass on to the testifiers with me.
Representative Quam, I want to make sure I did this right. I'll repeat it if nothing else. The chair moves, I move that House File 3380 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
3117.
That's what I did. The chair moves that House File 3117 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. We will be laying this over. Please proceed. Welcome to the committee, sir.
Hi, thank you. My name is John Klaus. My wife, Denise, and I live in Orinoco, Minnesota, which is a small town north of Rochester on Highway 52. Thank you, Chairman Mariani and committee members, for allowing us to be here to speak with you. We would like to take this opportunity to explain why we approached Representative Quam about this legislation and would like to thank him for sponsoring this bill. Our son Matthew lived in Rochester. He had a good job that he enjoyed, recently earning an associate's degree in finance at RCTC, and has a 13-year-old son he loved. Matthew also struggled for a long time with substance abuse. After some recent legal problems, he had been sober for 14 months. In February of 2019, he confided to me that he was struggling, that he relapsed, was drinking heavily, and even used heroin again, but he said he had a plan. On March 30th, 2019, almost 1 year ago, I found Matthew dead in his home. He was 32 years old. Toxicology reports confirmed my suspicion. Cause of death was heroin and fentanyl overdose. 2 days after his death, we were informed by a friend that Matt was being used as a confidential informant by the Rochester Police Department and that arrest had been made in his death. This information was provided as a link in a text message. Both the Post Bulletin and KTTC-TV knew and broadcast this information before we were told. We contacted Rochester Police, hoping to get details about his role with them. We were told that Matt approached them to become a confidential informant. He told them he wanted to get dealers off the street so he couldn't buy from them, and then word would get out further preventing him from buying drugs. Shortly after Matt's death, several stories and editorials were written by the Star Tribune, Rochester's Post Bulletin, and KTTC-TV. Some of those reporters are here today. They brought to our attention information that caused us to realize that there needs to be work done to better protect addicts, in recovery or not, when being used as confidential informants. We've provided these articles and other information to Representative Quam, but they highlight three points. The use of confidential informants is critical for law enforcement to do their job in protecting the community against drugs and other crime. Confidential informants can do things that trained law enforcement is unable to do. Two, there is an inherent risk to an addict in recovery or not when buying drugs as a confidential informant. There is a danger to the sobriety of the addict when the dealer puts heroin into their hands and is then required to turn it over to law enforcement. This danger is not always understood by the addict, nor by law enforcement, nor anyone else not familiar with chemical dependency problems. Three, there tends to be secrecy by law enforcement in their policies regarding the use of confidential informants. They don't want to be constrained in how they operate, and they state that transparency in their policies would provide operating methods and techniques to bad people, compromising their ability to effectively use CIs. They also do not publish information on how often they employ CIs, nor any results, good, bad, or catastrophic. Our observation is that there is no standard policy for law enforcement when using confidential informants. We were provided copies of the Rochester confidential informant use policy and cooperating individual agreement forms by a reporter. Subsequent to this article, the article that was written, others were no longer able to get copies. The policy is less than 2 pages long, and while the policy states the purpose of this policy is to establish guidelines for the safe and effective utilization of confidential informants, there is little that actually addresses safety, and those references are vague as to how. I believe that law enforcement understands how to provide physical safety for a CI during the actual transaction, but I also believe that safety with respect to relapse and sobriety is not understood, if even a concern. One policy item states officers shall not utilize a person on parole or probation as a CI unless established and agreed upon protocols with the community corrections are followed. Matt was on probation, but his PO was never informed. I personally had called Matt's probation officer on 2 occasions, as well as calling RPD for a welfare check on Matt in the period before his involvement with the police. I told him Matt was using again and urged him to get help for Matt. Sadly, if the PO was then informed by the police about using Matt to buy drugs, he may have remembered my calls and worked a plan for Matt. The cooperating individual agreement is a similar document in that it appears to merely have the confidential informant acknowledge that Rochester Police provides no benefits to the CI and seems to exist purely to protect the police from any liability. Rochester Police was quoted as saying that the benefits of using confidential informants outweigh the danger, that the risk is worth it. But RPD is not taking the risk. The confidential informant is, and the risk to recovery and sobriety is not being addressed. Matt made 3 buys to a local dealer for the police with a 4th planned. As I mentioned, Matt had told RPD his rationalization was to prevent relapse by getting dealers off the street and then being blackballed by other dealers. It's not clear exactly where Matt was in his sobriety when he started working with RPD. He had certainly relapsed, and with the advantage of hindsight, it was clear that he was worried about his ability to get back into recovery. That he was worried that his ability to get back into recovery was in jeopardy. Allowing him to buy heroin, a process that puts heroin into his hands, seems almost irresponsible now. If Matt had someone trained in addiction counseling helping him get through this, flags would have gone up and hopefully he would have received help. Denise and I want to acknowledge that the use of confidential informants is probably necessary for law enforcement. We are not advocating to stop this process. We realize that law enforcement has a very difficult job and protecting our communities is vital. What we are asking for is that in exchange for the valuable services that they provide, law enforcement puts into place protections to help get the CI into sobriety or be able to stay sober if that is what they choose. We believe this can be done without hindering law enforcement's ability to use them. The bill that Representative Quam has introduced does not specify a policy. It instructs professionals from both law enforcement and mental health substance abuse counseling communities to create a policy that would enable law enforcement to properly vet a CI and provide training to officers in how to use them safely. This is not a new problem. There are model policies and model agreements already in existence. I've come to believe that addicts should be considered vulnerable adults, that they should be treated as valuable employees and not disposable assets. They should be provided an advocate whose primary role is for the safety of the confidential informant. Responsibilities would include explaining risks to the CI, assessing the CI to determine a risk of relapse before, during, and after the use, a person that the CI can talk to as a counselor. In Matt's case, a trained advocate would have picked up on signs that Matt knew his sobriety to be at risk. The CI should have access to health care, including treatment, as would any employee. There should be an emergency contact provided. We should not have learned about Matt's CI role from the internet. The state should have oversight in the use of confidential informants. Matt's death would have gone without inspection except for news reporters. Video footage in which Rochester Oversight Committee questioned RPD about the original Star Tribune article was very disappointing. There were no questions that asked for details about what happened, no requests for case notes, only a question about whether their policy was followed, a policy that has no substance except for the requirement to work with Matt's PO, a policy item that was violated. We are not aware of any follow-up investigation by RPD or any other agency. No acknowledgement that a tragedy had happened, nor discussions of what might have been done to avoid this in the future. If this is typical, then oversight is necessary. Lastly, the important part of this bill is that all law enforcement agencies are expected to adopt a new policy. Thank you again for this opportunity to talk. I apologize if I've provided more detail than necessary if I've talked too long. I would be happy to provide any details to anyone. I would be happy to talk to people one-on-one. It's been a difficult year for our family, and we believe that this bill will help us heal, knowing that it will provide necessary protection to future informants. And my wife, Denise, just has a few words to add.
Thank you. Mr. Flaus, and we are unfortunately needing to vacate this room. We're all supposed to be at another meeting in a few minutes. If you have just a few seconds, and I don't mean to be disrespectful at all. There's no need to apologize, sir. We are sharing grief and sorrow with your loss and your beloved son. But Ms. Floss, if you have perhaps just a few seconds, and
half a page,
and then we're going to have to leave the room, unfortunately.
I've only got a small amount here.
Okay,
very good. It's about a minute.
Thank you.
Chairman Mariani and council members, thank you. This is the face of a confidential informant. On March 30th last year, we lost our son Matthew from an accidental overdose of heroin, which was laced with fentanyl. This occurred while Matthew was helping the RPD as a confidential informant, and we found out that he was an informant from a friend who saw it in the news. We were not even given the consideration of a phone call from the police department to give us advance warning that his death would be announced in the news because of his role as an informant. If there had been a policy in effect that was written to protect the informant, Matthew might still be here today, and his family and many friends would not be grieving him. I want anyone acting as an informant to be treated with the respect that any employee would be given. These are people who have families and friends that care about them. And in the case of addicts, they have a disease. They should not have to sign away their rights while they help the police do their job. They should not be used and tossed aside. They are providing a service to their community at a risk to themselves. Their well-being, both physical and mental, should be an important consideration in this process. In some cases, the CI is helping in order to get a reduction of charges. Sometimes they want or need the money. And in Matthew's case, he wanted to help get the dealer off the street and help his sobriety. But no matter the reason, the risk is the same for all of them. I'm asking that you look seriously at this bill and help to protect the safety and rights of future informants. Matthew was a son, a father, a brother, and a friend. And a bill like this would have better protected him, and maybe we all wouldn't be grieving him today. Thank you for allowing me the time to speak to you. And thank you to Representative Quam for taking up this issue and helping us put this bill together.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony, Ms. Floss. And again, we share our sympathies and our sense of loss with you. I have children in my early 30s, and I just can't imagine. Appreciate your courage and your honoring your son by bringing forward legislation that hopefully could avoid this happening again to somebody else's beloveds. So, Representative Quam, we're going to lay this bill over. We're going to continue to work on it. We'll need to hear from law enforcement for sure. We have had the Pulse Board here. They've heard all of these bills, and so there may be good opportunities also to follow up with them at the board. But thank you for bringing this bill forward. Members, the chair lays over House File 3117. And members, until next week, this committee stands adjourned.